I'm listening to the show every morning, and you can say it's grand. It's not grand if you're not on it, though.
OTB's Mount Rushmore.
Some talent in Cork, isn't there? Wow. A few of the GAA boys weren't happy, but it was my sporting hero. I was contesting, I think, against Jimmy Barry Murphy. So once you're in that company, everything is good.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
It's very, very special. Believe me, I think it becomes more special when you're on the coach, because it's something, unfortunately, inside me that's ultra competitive, and I need to be there.
Catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM on the OTB Podcast Network. The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Culture Hall of Fame.
Brought to you by Now TV. Watch whatever you're in the mood for.
Right, this week's OTB Culture Hall of Fame in association with Now TV is none other than Paul Howard, who has brought the best bookshelf game that we've seen of this entire lockdown so far. This is a power of intimidation akin to something you'd see in a mafia film, Paul.
This is wallpaper, just to let you know. If you look really, really careful, you'll see the pattern repeats itself. So people will probably think he's got 6 copies of that book, but no, it's just wallpaper.
Is this your actual work? Is this where you do your writing?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. It's got two walls lined with books, which has another advantage, because when I record in here, when I do the weekly podcast, it's soundproof. So I don't need to sort of fiddle around with volumes and all that kind of thing. But this is my torture chamber.
So you've been working at home essentially for years.
Yeah. I mean, I've kind of been, you know, especially the first sort of 4 or 5 months of the year, I'm kind of socially isolating anyway. I'm always, this time of year, I always have a Ross or Kyle Kelly book deadline. This year I have we're doing a second Gordon Darcy children's book. And then I have a third book, which I've just finished as well. And that's since the beginning of January. So I wasn't really having much of a life anyway. So I don't have that sort of fear of missing out that I often do, when I'm working.
When are we going to get to find out about the third book? That sounds interesting.
Next year, it's a children's book. It's not sport related at all. It's completely different to anything I've ever done before. It's a kind of fantasy book for children. And just an idea I had a few years back, and I was kind of just looking for time really to do it. I think I came up with the idea about 8 years ago, and just didn't have the time, but then got a bit of time this year, obviously with the lockdown and everything, I'm not missing anything.
How do you find your productivity levels on a general basis, Paul? I think that's something that a lot of people have probably struggled with over the last 2 months or so. Is it possible for you to just sit in that room, that torture chamber, and bash out your best work?
Yeah, I think like a deadline is a great way of concentrating your mind, I think, and I always find that I work quite well. I take deadlines very seriously, I think, because I worked in newspapers for years, and because my first boss was Vincent Brown. It was just, if somebody told you that something had to be ready by, your deadline was 5 o'clock on Thursday, it was 5 o'clock on Thursday. And if you didn't deliver, it wasn't, you might as well not write it, because it wasn't going in the paper. So when I started working for myself, when I left sports journalism and started writing books for a living, I tried to maintain the same hours that I did when I was a journalist. So I get up very early in the morning. I'm a morning person. So, like since lockdown, actually since the beginning of January, I've been up most mornings at about 5 o'clock.
Right.
And I do my best work between kind of 5 and lunchtime. And then the afternoon, who knows, if I can bring myself to, I'm usually so tired by then, I can't actually trust anything I've written. Like I read it back the next day and I go, God, who wrote this?
Well, in fairness, that's still a 7-hour shift between 5 and 12. I'm just working the maths out in your head. A lot of people, I'd say, are just kind of rolling out of bed and then actually trying to get cracky on things. And you've already done 7 hours at that point. I'd say you're not beating yourself up too much if there's some afternoons where you're like, can't find the words today.
I remember seeing this great interview with Mike Tyson once, and he was talking about how he used to get up at 4:30 in the morning to run. And they asked him, why do you run at 4:30? And he said, because he found out one of his opponents was getting up at five, and he felt that he would, I think it was Larry Holmes, that he would have a psychological advantage from being up for half an hour before before Larry Holmes. I'm a bit like that as well. We were always like that in our house. We were very much a lark family rather than an owl family. So it's just what's always worked for me. I just, my mind is just fresher at that time of the day.
Is it any coincidence that you found the time to write an idea that you had 8 years ago just as football gets cancelled? Is there anything that's maybe linking these two things in your head at all?
Oh, look, I mean, that's completely it. I've nothing to do, you know? Like, my dad still rings me on a Saturday and says, did you get the football results? You know, just, we're still living in this fantasy world that is still going on, you know? And he rings me just to kind of, you know, he likes to remind himself what it feels like to actually discuss football. I have a lot more time on my hands now. I think I've a lot, you know, fewer distractions. I'm not kind of checking websites every 5 minutes to see if Liverpool bought anybody or who's injured or anything like that. You know, that's, you know, sometimes I go on the BBC sport website and I realize they haven't actually refreshed the page for about 48 hours, you know, or you're reading a feature on it that you were reading 3 days ago. I think there's definitely a lot fewer distractions around the place, a lot fewer things to think about.
It does seem very Liverpool that a global pandemic will prevent them from lifting the trophy when they were so far ahead that it was absolutely impossible for them to be caught.
It's very Liverpool, yeah. I started following Liverpool when it was easy to follow Liverpool, you know, like a lot of Liverpool fans of my age, a great many of whom work in the media. We started following them in the 70s when it was just easy, like, you know, winning titles was like having a birthday. If you just hung around long enough, it was on the way. And so the last 30 years, I mean, there's been so many low points. There's been a few kind of false dawns, a few times when you thought, you know, especially under Rafa, when you thought this is the start of something, you know, and it's just so bizarre. It's just, and there's a woman who works in she's the local postmistress here, and I go into the post office and she's a huge Liverpool fan. Her name is Mary. And when I go in, we always banter about Liverpool, you know, and I went in yesterday and I was wearing a mask, like, you know, and I was just across here. And I'm so used to wearing the mask now, I've actually forgotten I'm wearing it. And I walked in and we just kind of mused on the fact that if I'd walked in like that 3 months ago, she would have pressed the panic button. And it's just, you know, between that and then, you know, looking at each other and saying, Liverpool, is it ever going to happen? It's just kind of reinforces just the strangeness of this time we're living through now.
It is totally bizarre. And I guess, like, your job is to be creative. How much of the raw stuff that we read every week, is that written in the moment? Are you filing every week for that? And does that come in the book, or do you write the book?
No, the books, in the early days, the first few Ross books I wrote, they contained a lot of the material that had been featured in columns. But now they're completely different, you know. In fact, the timelines have run in separate directions. So in the books, Ross had five children, and in the column for a long time he only had two because he'd had these triplets in the book. So I had to keep them separate because I didn't want to give away spoilers in the column. So he had five in one and two in the other. So I had to at one point just sort of slip in the fact into the Irish Times column that he had these triplets in the house. Anyway, I was getting all these messages, like over 100 messages from people saying, triplets? Where the hell did these triplets come from? But I'd had to get them in somehow because I just couldn't ignore the fact that he had them. But the columns, I try to keep them current. And I suppose at the moment, I can't write about anything other than the lockdown. I can't have Ross out there in the world or, you know, Charles out there in the world. So they're all stuck in this little house on the Vico Road. Well, this huge house on the Vico Road in Glynneagh, and they're isolating there. So for the last sort of 8 weeks, the column has been just about trying to survive each other, really, you know. And it's a challenge. It is a challenge as a writer that you know, you've just got one location and you've got these sort of eight characters sharing the same space. And it's the challenge, I suppose, of keeping it interesting, finding something new to write about every week.
I guess it gives you a good theme, and I'm not sure if it helps or not, actually, but it is certainly a theme to focus on every week. And I wonder if writing and comedy writing in general is just going to have a swathe of brilliant coronavirus content when this is over. But now that you say it, it's probably happening right now.
It's really difficult with something like this because you just have to be really careful about deciding what your targets are or where the comedy is, where the jokes are, where the punchlines are, because you have to sort of, you have to keep remembering that, you know, it's really, really serious. And, people are struggling with it, you know, with the disease and then also with the financial effects of it as well. And we have no idea what they're going to be, you know, what a blow it's going to be to the economy. We've some idea, but no idea how great it's going to be. So I suppose you're writing comedy at times like this, you're always a lot more tentative, I think. I agonize over every line a lot more than I would ordinarily. And I read it back and I try to imagine, right, if I'm reading this, how does this read? But it's difficult. It is always difficult at a time like this to be standing up telling jokes, I think.
Or talking about football or talking about, you know, matches that happened 25 years ago in a way. But I guess you also feel a responsibility to be that 10 minutes of distraction when people flick to that page in the magazine, that it is something that they're going to enjoy and will at the same time reflect what the world is happening in the world, but take them out of it in some way as well.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, it is light entertainment, and I know what you mean. There's, you know, if you go on social media and talk about anything other than COVID-19 at the moment, you're always going to get people who say, how can you talk about X when Y is happening? And that's just, I suppose, the nature of social media. It's the nature of the human condition as well. But yeah, I mean, what I write is satire. So while trying to remain funny, I also try to sort of reflect something of what's going on at the time and maybe, some of the madness of the time as well.
Let's get into that, because the whole point of the OTB Culture Hall of Fame is that we ask people to bring something that's going to go into it. And I just want to remind everybody that is in association with Now TV, you can stream every episode of the unmissable new show Gangs of London on the Now TV Entertainment Pass. An Irish boss, Colm Meaney, a leading gang member across all of London, is assassinated, leaving his son to keep his family and the business together. A 14-day free trial is available now. It stars Colm Meaney and Joe Cole, who was on the show last week and put City of God into the OTB Culture Hall of Fame, which is a brilliant movie. I suspect your character from this week would be able to solve the conundrum at the heart of Gangs of London if he just put his mind to it. You want to put Columbo into the Culture Hall of Fame?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Columbo, to me, it's the greatest TV show ever made. I know it's pushing on for 40 years now since the first episode. But actually, it's pushing on for 50 years since the first episode. But I think it's one of those TV shows that still holds up. It's completely different to any other crime drama that went before or has come since, in that the format is totally inverted. It's not a whodunit. William Link and Richard Leveson, who wrote it, said it was a how catch 'em instead of a whodunit. So you found out in the very, very first scene who the killer was, why he did it, and how he did it. And so you know more than the detective inside the first 5 minutes. And the show is essentially how this character, Columbo, picks apart the story every week, how he solves the crime. And it's all kind of old-fashioned police work, you know. So there's no, like, it's never kind of, you know, DNA or anything. You never hear him say, like, we'll get a DNA match on that. Like, he catches the killer out in a lie. And his powers of observation. The great thing about Columbo is he's very unlike any other detective in that he's really, really scatterbrained. And it feels weird me explaining who Columbo is to people, but I realize there are a lot of people, even people over the age of 30, who aren't really familiar with the show. But he's this sort of shambling detective. He's a lieutenant in the LAPD in the homicide division. And he wears this kind of raincoat, this dirty beige raincoat, these sort of high top brogues, we would call them, in the sweltering LA weather, you know. He always has this little cigar, this little stogie between his fingers and this ash dropping off the end of it. And he walks into a crime scene and he's spilling ash everywhere. And, you know, he takes out his notebook and he discovers he's got his wife's shopping list is written in his police notebook. And he said, I must get that later on. And he always meets the murderer. The first person he meets when he gets to the scene is, it's generally the murderer. And he knows it almost immediately, this is the guy who did it. And the show is essentially how he psychologically picks them apart. So he has all of these tricks that he uses to do that. So just to sort of wrong foot people, he pretends to be really forgetful. Quite often the murderer is somebody who's quite famous. So they'll be an author or a famous composer or an actor, because it's set in mostly Hollywood. And he would just break off from a conversation with the killer to say, my wife is your biggest fan. My wife absolutely loves your stuff. And then he kind of leads the killer along by telling him, you know, I need your big brain to help me solve this crime. And the killer is generally flattered and thinks this guy's an idiot, so I can kind of control the way the investigation goes. But Columbo was always too clever, you know, and he has this great device, and it kind of became his catchphrase. He leaves a room, he says something really unsettling to the killer, and then he leaves the room, and then when the killer looks really worried, he comes back in and says, just one more thing. And just one more thing is usually something really anodyne, like that wasn't relevant at all, but it's just to kind of just to unsettle the guy.
Is it funny? Is it supposed to be funny along the way?
Yeah, I mean, there's some of the later ones that Peter Falk made for ABC, he kind of hammed it up a little bit, you know. He's a funny character, but I think in those the golden period for Columbo was kind of 71 to 78, which was when it was on NBC, and it was they were absolutely brilliant. Later on, it became a little bit Hallmarky, and the catchphrases became kind of the thing, you know, and it was a little bit hammy. But it's absolutely hilarious, because you realize the stakes are so serious, and he stresses the killer out. I mean, basically, in almost every single episode, at the very end, when Columbo solves the case and essentially just does his ta-da moment, which is, you know, this is how I've solved it, the killer willfully kind of holds up his wrists and says, put the bracelets on, and happily goes off to the electric chair, I presume, because Columbo has so defeated him psychologically. So what classically happens is, I said it a second ago, that Columbo, he flatters them and tells them, you know, my wife loves you and all this kind of, will you sign this book for my wife? And then there comes a point in the investigation where he keeps presenting his theories, and then there comes a point when the killer says, oh, Lieutenant Columbo, you really are a preposterous man. And then about 20 minutes later, it turns into this rage, like where he's saying, you know, get out, Lieutenant, and sort of throws him out of the house. And then, you know, the next time they meet is going to be the end game.
It's incredible that for a television show that ran for 32 years, it's got an IMDb rating of 8.2. Like, surely at some point over the 32 years, the rating would slip. And as you say, even between different broadcast companies, different writers, you would imagine that the standards would slip, but not for Columbo. Like, is this something that you remember watching from as young as you can remember? And is it something that through the decades was part of your life?
No, I'd say I discovered it quite late.
Right.
The first season, first sort of 7 or 8 seasons, well, I was kind of like 5 or 6, so I was too young to watch it. But in the late 80s, ABC bought the rights and started making new ones. And that was the time when RTE got a hold of all the old ones and started showing them. So I was probably about 17 when I discovered it. I think the reason it's got that rating is because it's pure storytelling. Like, there's no gimmicks in Columbo. It's not, you know, there's no fight sequences. There's no difficult arrests. There's no, I don't even remember, there aren't many kind of police sirens, like, you know, going off. It's purely police procedural stuff. And it's kind of just great storytelling, great writing. I think that's why it's kind of survived, like why it sort of measures up against, you know, some of the later cop dramas. And it's the cleverness of how he actually solves the crimes.
How important is Peter Falk in all this? Is it possible to get anywhere near the reverence for this television show without him?
No, I mean, he really is Columbo. There was a story I read somewhere that Bing Crosby was originally considered for the role, which would be very, very strange indeed. But you just can't separate Columbo from the character, so much so that when you see Peter Falk in anything else, it looks odd. You know, you kind of expect him to go back into character any minute. And you forget that Peter Falk was a really successful actor before he became Columbo. He had two Oscar nominations for gangster movies. He was always in gangster movies because he looked so rough. He only had one eye. One of his eyes was prosthetic. He had cancer of the eye as a child, and the eye was removed when he was 3 years old. So he could never get romantic leads because he had one eye. So he was always cast as gangsters. He played this kind of Che Guevara type character in a movie as well, but mostly it was kind of hoodlums. And then the Columbo thing came along. But I've seen him in other things, and I just can't accept him in anything else. He's just so strong in that role.
It's definitely something that becomes a kind of, I don't want to say cultural moment, but like a lot of people queue up to be in this, and it's got some famous alumni as directors as well. Steven Spielberg did an episode, for example.
Yeah, Steven Spielberg did. I think it was the first non-pilot episode, and it was a fantastic. It's actually my favorite episode. It's the first non-pilot episode shown on television, and it's about these two authors, and they write these crime books together, and one of them has decided he wants to break up the partnership and wants to go it alone. So the other author lures him to this cabin in the woods where they're going to celebrate with a weekend of hunting, and he kills him, and he thinks he's committed the perfect crime because he's put all this work into it. And Columbo arrives on the scene, and he knows instantly that this guy did it, and he just sort of picks him apart. The other great thing about Columbo, because I realize I'm telling you the entire plot here, it's perfect for me because my nickname at home is Spoiler Alert, because I ruin absolutely everything. Like, I ruined Shutter Island. I ruined, all of these movies that have a big reveal at the end. I'm the one in the cinema who shouts out, Kaiser Soze! Do you know who was great as Kaiser Soze in that movie? I ruin everything. The great thing about Columbo is you can't ruin it because everybody knows who did it right from the start. Frankie Boyle has this funny line in his one of his stand-up routines where he talks about his grandmother watching Columbo, and an hour in she says, "I think I know who did it."
it's far more difficult to do and to make that gripping, isn't it? Like, the as you say, the device of, say, a fight scene, or even the quest of tracking someone down or finding out who did it, is far easier. Like, I'm not shooting down that form of television whatsoever, because when that's done, it's exceptional as well. But this is definitely a greater achievement. I think it's almost like in Cold Blood, when Truman tells you exactly who's done it, and you just want to figure out why.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the tension around it as well. And one of the other great things about Columbo was that the killer wasn't always an unsympathetic character. And most, I think most crime dramas you watch now, you know, you're supposed to hate the killer. And quite often you actually like the killer in Columbo because they've killed, you know, from the opening sequence that maybe they're being blackmailed or they've got this, you know, problem in their life. Or but there's all sorts of reasons why people kill, and they go through the whole gamut in Columbo. But sometimes he really, really likes the killer. And there's a great episode. There's a character in it called Abigail Mitchell, and she's also a writer, as it happens. And she kills her son-in-law because she suspects that he killed her missing daughter years earlier. Columbo gets to really like her, and they become great friends, but he's still trying to break her down. And there's a lovely moment in it where she says to him, I think you and I have become really good friends. And he says, but don't count on it. It's just such an amazing moment, like, you know, and she's just left with her mouth open because it's the first moment when she realizes that he knows she did it. But it's always like, you know, like I said, there's no chases or anything like that. There's no fight scenes, but it doesn't mean there's no tension. Like there's a great scene in one episode where Columbo realizes the killer is a cigar smoker. And he tells the suspect, his lead suspect, who he's still kind of befriended at this stage, and the friend is smoking the cigar, and he said, I believe the killer is a cigar smoker. And this guy still has the cigar between his fingers. And he said, why do you say that? And he said, the night the body was discovered, there was a match in the ashtray, and the match was burned right down to kind of like this much. And he said, if it was a cigarette smoker, it would just be there. And of course your man has the cigar in his burning between his fingers. So there was always great moments of tension. You know, you don't need a fight sequence or, you know, 30 cars destroyed in a chase to actually have tension in a cop drama.
And I've just checked, it's on YouTube. The official Columbo channel has put up Murder by the Book season 1, episode 1. It has over 2 million views, 2.2 million views. So and you can dig this out if you want to go looking for it. It's not that hard to find.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they're great. There's an Irish one actually that's kind of worth looking at. I think it's called, it'll come to me in a second. I can't remember at the moment. But it's shockingly bad, like, because it's a kind of American 1970s representation of Ireland. But
The
Conspirators. He's an IRA gun runner, the killer, and he kills an arms dealer. And it's kind of strange just to see, you know, he keeps talking about the old country, and he keeps breaking into song. Anytime he's drinking whiskey, he breaks into, he sings, God Save Ireland, said the hero, you know, gives it the full, on the weather, on the gallows high, or the battlefield we die, the full God Save Ireland. So it's really naff, but it's kind of, it's just a great example of kind of television at that time as well. You know, there's a, it's kind of a funny caricature, you know, but what's great about that particular episode is how Columbo solves that crime. It's one of the best, of any of the episodes. So it doesn't matter, even if at any point, you know, the characterization was weak or the script was weak, the procedure stuff saved every episode.
Well, I will say that you didn't reveal how it got solved there, so you're not living up to your spoiler alert nickname.
I would like to encourage people to watch them.
Paul, we've kind of buried the lead here a small bit. You have paid your respect at Peter Falk's grave. You're that big a fan of Columbo.
I did actually. I went, his coat is in the Smithsonian in Washington, and I went to see his coat when I was there for the Mike Tyson Kevin McBride fight about 15 years ago, and I was more excited about seeing the coat than I was the fight. It just happened to be closed the day I went, so I never got to see it. But Mary and I, we were in Los Angeles about 3 years ago, and he's buried in the cemetery in Westwood in Los Angeles, and it's right in the middle of this really kind of built up area there's this tiny little cemetery behind an office building, and he's buried in there. And another great hero of mine, Roy Orbison, is buried in there as well. So I wanted to go and pay my respects at his grave. But I found out there's lots of famous people buried there, including Marilyn Monroe. And Joe DiMaggio, in his will, left money for fresh flowers to be put on our grave every day for eternity.
And, wow!
And we saw the flowers being put there while we were standing around, like looking at Columbo's grave. It was a pretty amazing place.
Jesus,
that really is
a great contract
shot.
For a florist. Yeah. I mean,
there must surely be a day in like 1,000 years when the money runs out, but who knows?
Or whoever the investor is. Billy Connolly was in an episode, and a bunch of other actors kind of queued up to be in it. It was like an event for your career to be in an episode.
Yeah,
it reached that kind of level.
Yeah, some of them worked and some of them didn't work. Actually, Billy Connolly was one of the ones that didn't work. He was... And I think he was too big as Billy Connolly. You were too aware of the fact that he's this hilarious Scottish comedian who generally usually only has to speak for me to laugh. And he was just being particularly unfunny. He didn't have any funny lines in it. So it was so that one didn't work. But Leonard Nimoy was in the very first pilot episode, and he plays this surgeon who murders his master by... he performs heart surgery on him, and he uses dissolving sutures, and it's a brilliant episode. And the chemistry, the hatred between Columbo and this doctor character, the surgeon character, it's really, really sparky. It's the only episode I think where Columbo actually loses his temper, because he's just kind of one mood the whole time. But it's the only time he actually shouts. He shouts at one of the killers and loses his rag. Johnny Cash is in one episode, and it's one of the best as well. He plays this Bible thumping preacher singer type, and himself essentially. And he kills. I'm sorry, I'm spoiling it. Okay, but he kills his ex-wife and manager, who is bribing him, and he's trying to get away from him. He wants to go off and do other kinds of music, and he kills her in this really kind of inventive way. They go up in a plane, and he arranges for the plane to crash by fiddling with the engine, and he jumps out in a parachute and leaves the plane to crash, and he pretends he's kind of survived in the wreckage, and Columbo smells a rat straight away. But that's one of the great episodes, and that's one of the examples of, you know, an established star who comes in and is just really good. And you actually forget he's Johnny Cash, or you don't care that he's Johnny Cash, because he's such a great character in it.
It's funny how some TV programs can work with the big stars and some can't. And I guess if you have 60 odd episodes, there are going to be some duds in there, but it's great to have the good ones. So you mentioned Leonard Nimoy, obviously was William Shatner, Vincent Price,
yeah,
Martin Sheen.
Yeah, yeah. Ray Milland, you know, anyone who was anyone. I think there's something like 4 or 5 Oscar winners have appeared as villains in it after winning Oscars, like, you know. So
right.
It was, they all wanted to do it, and that wasn't the way it was at the time. You know, now all Hollywood stars want to do television, but it wasn't like that at the time. So, you know, the show just shows you how, you know, what an impact it had on people, you know. And this was back in the day when it was real go-to TV. You know, there was a sense that everybody sat down and watched the latest episode of Columbo. Yeah, absolutely everybody wants to be in it.
I guess we forget about that, really, that whole, you know, we can, quick Google, you find it on YouTube, that first episode is there, 2 million people have watched it in the last 2 years, and that's just on one platform. It's probably loads of other different places as well. But you do forget that these series, so much money went into them. There was only 3 or 4 that each of the TV companies made, which meant that there wasn't that much choice every year. So it had to be good for it to survive, and it had to have some kind of support from the public as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, to tell you how big it was, like, it made, you know, Columbo was on the cover of Time magazine. I actually have the picture here.
Oh, wow.
Can you see that? Is there a shine on? That.
TV's year of the cop.
So it was absolutely huge. This is hanging in my bathroom, but visitors to the house think it's very strange. They think a crumble hanging in your bathroom. I have to explain it to them.
Just one more thing, literally just one more thing. Not only about going to see his grave, but you've got his dog as well.
Yeah, we he's here. The only problem, Humphrey is the name. He's a Basset Hound. Humphrey, come here. The only problem with Basset Hounds is they never do what they're told. And this was what kind of drew me to Columbo, to a Basset Hound, that Columbo had one and it was called Dog and it never ever did anything. He had to carry it everywhere. Like, you know, they're huge. This dog is 30 kilos. And Columbo takes it to the vet regularly, you know, and he says, he just won't do anything. He just sits there. He won't do anything. And I just thought, that's the dog for me. That's what I want. I want this lazy dog who refuses to move. But anyway, it turned out he wasn't like that at all. Like, he's got tons of energy and you're just constantly fighting with him as well, you know? But it was purely down to Columbo. It just, I think he might be coming in. No. I'd send you a picture.
That was the perfect finale there, where he doesn't do what he's told and doesn't do what he's told.
Ever. No, there's some treats here. I'm trying to kind of, I've got a sort of Hansel and Gretel type trail of treats coming over here to try and get him. Here, Humphrey, come here. Come here. Here. Hang on. I'll move this slightly.
Oh.
No. Oh, he's just shy.
The big reveal. All right. He's camera shy. Paul, you've been great. This is exactly what we wanted for this week's OTB Culture Hall of Fame with Now TV. Columbo, it's 100% going in, and we'll get people to dig that out on YouTube. Paul Harrod, you're a gent. Thanks very much. A reminder, of course, you can stream every episode of the unmissable new show Gangs of London on the Now TV Entertainment Pass. An Irish boss, Colm Meaney, a leading gang member across all of London, is assassinated, leaving his son to keep his family and the business together. You got a 14-day free trial if you want it, starring Colm Meaney and Joe Cole, who was last week's guest on the show. Recommend you dig that out as well. We'll take a quick break back after these.
The OTB Culture Hall of Fame.
Brought to you by Now TV. Watch whatever you're in the mood for.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.